dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A colleague of mine who has fought in a variety of capacities in that war with great distinction, notably in the uniform of the United States Marines Force Reconnaissance Special Forces, is our first guest. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He is speaking, of course, in his civilian capacity, which is as the director of the Center for Security Policy's Infrastructure Security Project. He has been working tirelessly and for quite a number of years now to address the most critical of our critical infrastructure security challenges, namely that of our electrical grid. Because after all, as listeners to this program know, if we don't have an electric grid, we're not going to have any other critical infrastructure, nor indeed a society, let alone the land of the free and the home of the brave of the United States of America. We're wanting to catch up with Tommy to talk about several interesting and potentially quite important developments in the electric grid security business. Tommy has been leading the Center for Security Policy-sponsored Secure the Grid Coalition and has been following very closely these developments. We're delighted to have him with us. Tommy, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank, for having me on.
There's an important development, potentially, Tommy, and that is that the Biden administration has let it be known that they're now worried about domestic terrorists having in their crosshairs our electric grid. I'd like to ask you about two pieces of this, and let me start with the first, which is, who are they talking about in terms of domestic terrorists, do you think? And how credible a threat do you regard that?
Yeah, Frank. So a couple things. First is, I haven't seen a copy of the actual Department of Homeland Security report. What we have seen are a few media articles, right? So CNN, ABC, The Daily Beast, the headlines kind of seem to say it all with respect to who they think are the problem here. For example, the Daily Beast headline, DHS warns that right-wing extremists could attack the power grid. CNN, electric grid is attractive target for domestic violent extremists in the U.S. So what we've seen over the last year is a significant effort to direct attention toward what they're calling domestic violent extremists, or DVEs, which in many cases are you know, labels that are applied by the current administration, in some cases on their political enemies. What we also know is the grid is absolutely vulnerable to attack. It's just interesting that until recently, when there was a focus on these, quote, domestic violent extremists, it seemed as though the physical vulnerabilities of the grid were not that big of a deal. And I'll give you an example, Frank. A year ago this week, we had filed a complaint with FERC. This is the federal regulator for the bulk power grid, that the physical security and enforcement standards to protect the grid against this physical attack that these news articles warn about, that those standards were inefficient, they were inadequate and under-enforced. And ultimately, the federal government dismissed that complaint. So, Frank, you know very well that our coalition has been trying to raise the alarm about the vulnerability of the grid to all hazards, including physical sabotage. And for whatever reason, it never really made the headlines until there was, quote, domestic violent extremists that they were concerned might attack it.
I think this is unfortunately cynical on their part, but in a way, as you say, Tommy, it at least implicitly acknowledges a very significant reality and makes all the more urgent the need to remedy it, namely that our grid is vulnerable. And whether it's the people that they ascribe malign intentions to, whether they're oh, I don't know, conservatives or their Trump voters or their veterans or their gun owners or any of the others that they consider to be, you know, potential domestic terrorists, school board attending moms among them. The grid vulnerability yawns before us, and actual potential domestic terrorists, whether they're Marxists or Sharia supremacists or somebody else, let alone foreign adversaries, I think probably are a very real threat to its continued viability. And that brings me to another question that we touched on with Peter last week, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about it. The budget that has been put forward by the Biden administration with respect to this so-called infrastructure bill, we're told, actually envisions spending billions of dollars on the electric grid. Tommy, from your study of this with the Secure the Grid Coalition, and I, again, commend tremendously the work of that coalition, and it can be found at securethegrid.com, you have some sense of whether that money is, in fact, there, whether it's, yes, going to be used for the grid, but, you know, making it greener and more dependent upon technologies that, well, frankly, may or may not serve to make the grid more resilient, as we like to say. What's your reading on the state of this effort to what end?
So you're right, Frank. The infrastructure bill, as it's called, you know, $1.2 trillion, just gigantic amount of money. That money is beginning to make its way to places where it could make a difference if people are motivated to spend it wisely. We had some recent revelations last week. January 25th was the second meeting of the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm established this advisory board. It had its inaugural meeting in October, which we were participants in. And then last week, and they unveiled a number of things that show that they're ready to spend this money. And one of those is this new Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations. Now, to Dr. Pry's point, I think that you just expressed was there's a concern that the money might just be spent on research and development and not actually building out the things that we need to make the grid resilient. So that's a choice they have to make with this new Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations. And in fact, this is why a number of our colleagues in the Secure the Grid Coalition, including Ambassador Woolsey, you know, our co-director, who is the former director of Central Intelligence, we recently teamed up on an op-ed that I hope will be published soon that your listeners can read, where we argue the need for this new office to take a few really important steps to do demonstrations, right? If it's an Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, let's do some demonstrations, actual work to show what technologies are available to protect the grid and to test certain extremely important components of the grid against realistic hazards, right? That's what this new office is supposed to do, to demonstrate how the grid can work in realistic conditions. And one of those is in the face of electromagnetic pulse.
Well, I do worry about an office that has as its brand clean energy may have a very different focus than the one we need. But in principle, you're right. And in fact, you were involved in a recent meeting of the Secretary of Energy's advisory board, telephonic virtual meeting. But this issue of demonstration of, you know, both the vulnerability really of the grid and what might be done to make it more resilient was your topic. Discuss that a little bit, if you would, Tom.
Sure, Frank. Yeah, we made recommendations in her inaugural meeting and again in this second meeting that pertain to the security of the electric grid. Now, we had three major recommendations in the last meeting, and frankly, each of them could take up an entire 60-minute segment of the radio show. But there's two that I'll just mention briefly. One is that if they're so focused, as they should be, they should be focused on clean energy, right? But let's be realistic about it. We have the ability right now to take an extraordinary hazard, environmental and societal hazard, which is spent nuclear fuel, and we could produce clean carbon-free energy for the United States for up to 1,000 years. And that's a concept that we continually suggest to the Department of Energy and specifically to Secretary Granholm that they adopt as what they call one of their, quote, energy earth shots. So we recall the moon shot that America did. This is what they call an earth shot. And so that concept is described in the recommendation, and it will be described in our forthcoming op-ed. The second and much more urgent thing that they can do right now, Frank, is that they can test a multi-million dollar transformer donated by Duke Energy against realistic cyber and EMP threats. This transformer has languished for 4 years in a parking lot in North Charleston, South Carolina, when Duke Energy donated, right? So I want your listeners to understand, Frank, there has never been in the United States of America a test of a transformer, an extra high voltage transformer. And you know, this is the backbone of the grid. They are irreplaceable. We have never tested a transformer against EMP while it's under load, right? While it's working. And the Savannah River site, the Savannah River Research Laboratory, Savannah River Research Laboratory, has the capability to do these realistic tests and all for about $1 million to move this transformer up the Savannah River where it can be tested. And until then, Frank, all we rely on is the modeling, which has been provided for us by industry-funded studies, which the U.S. Air Force's Electromagnetic Defense Task Force found were dangerously optimistic. And so that's something that they can demonstrate right now. Test this transformer, see what happens when it's under load and hit with realistic EMP field strengths so that we know how to protect against EMP.
Tommy, I'm so glad you brought this up and that you had a chance to bring it up with Secretary Granholm as well. Did you get any kind of response from her? Because this is, well, first of all, it's outrageous on the one hand that a utility has actually volunteered to allow this major piece of capital investment to be used for this purpose. And it's been just hanging out there for 4 years. I pray that it hasn't degraded to the point where it's unusable. I don't know if you know whether that's the case or not, but that it's still up to the job of being a good test article. But did Secretary Granholm or her team indicate any interest in taking advantage of this opportunity at long last? Because it certainly seems like a no-brainer.
It is a no-brainer, Frank, unless there are certain people, whether in industry or government, that don't want the results of that test to ever be discovered, right?
I think that's for sure. That's why it's just been sitting there for 4 years,
exactly,
don't you
right.
think?
But I have to credit Secretary Granholm and her advisory board that they gave me the opportunity to make these recommendations, not during the public comment section, but at the end of their meeting. Frank, there were numerous people who called in for public comments, and those comments were dominated by climate activists and people seeking environmental justice and social justice. And so they just never had a chance to hear any further comments on grid security. So, you know, I asked at the end of their meeting as they adjourned, would you care to hear some recommendations on grid security? And I'm encouraged by the fact that they all stopped and sat back down and directed their full attention to hear the recommendations. And I even got an email thanking me for making those recommendations afterwards by the meeting's moderator. So that gives me at least the hope that our message was heard. Frank, these same recommendations have been made to the Department of Energy from the bottom up numerous times during both the Trump administration and throughout the last year plus time of the Biden administration. So none of this is new. What's new is that we're applying not only the bottom-up approach, but the top-down approach where we make it directly to the decision makers.
Look, I thank you for both being on that call and for seizing the day to get that information injected. It wouldn't have been on the agenda, evidently, and it wouldn't have been heard but for your efforts and leadership, Tommy. So kudos to you. it does need to be talked up. It does need to be acted upon. We'll be talking more with one of America's great authorities on energy security and most vocal proponents of it, Jackie Daly, who has a radio show on this subject momentarily, Tommy. But before we turn to her, I did want to just ask you one question about Texas, which will set up our conversations with her as well. You have been working closely with the community of San Antonio, Texas, which has had a remarkable effort underway to try to demonstrate how a city, a very important city in our country, Military City USA, they call it, can be made resilient and perhaps a model, therefore, for not only Texas, but for the nation. Very quickly, if you could, Tommy, in a minute or so, just tell us what's going on in San Antonio and is it promising in this regard?
What's happening in San Antonio, Frank, is really, it's called a pilot project, but it's what every city should be doing right now. And that is working on figuring out exactly how to protect their most critical infrastructures from all hazards, including electromagnetic pulse. The San Antonio Electromagnetic Defense, as it's called, is really one of these prominent places in the country leading the way. Lake Wylie, South Carolina is another. But in San Antonio, you have a special mix of the military, the civilian community, the critical infrastructure owners, and especially CPS Energy, their municipal utility that's embraced this concept. And so we're going to get an update, Frank, next Friday, in fact, the 11th. There will be a public quarterly meeting of the San Antonio Electromagnetic Defense where we'll find out just how much progress they've made in this endeavor. But it's a righteous endeavor, and it's one that needs to be replicated all across the country.
Absolutely. Well, Tommy, again, your leadership has been invaluable there as well, and we so appreciate all that you do at the Center for Security Policies, Secure the Great Coalition, and our infrastructure security program. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with updates on it all. Jackie Daly joins us next. More on the grid and what it means for you if we fail to make it resilient. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we are joined for the first time by Ambassador Andrew Bremberg. He is a man who has served his country in a variety of capacities with great distinction in the United States Senate Majority Leader's Office, the executive branch under President Trump. Capacity, he served as the director of his White House Domestic Policy Council, and then subsequently as an ambassador to the United Nations, in which he served in Geneva, working on a host of issues of importance to us all at the Office of the United Nations and other international organizations there. He has these days assumed particularly important responsibilities. It's hard to say they're more important than all of the foregoing, but they're very important in this moment. He is now the president and chief executive officer of an extraordinarily important organization here in Washington, D.C., the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. And I can't tell you how much I admire all that he is doing, and the Victims of Communism Foundation has in train at a moment when it is more important than ever that we not allow there to be more victims of communism. Andrew Bremberg, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio for the first time, I believe. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's so great to be with you.
Well, there's so much to talk about and so little time, but let me get right to it. There is a distinct possibility, I think it's fair to say, that Vladimir Putin of Russia, a man who served under the communist regime of the Soviet Union and the KGB, and who has said that the fall of that evil empire was the greatest catastrophe in the history of the 20th century. There are a lot of competitors for that dubious distinction. What do you make of the possibility that he will actually invade Ukraine? And should we care about that? We're kind of being told by some people that most of us admire included, that, you know, we really don't have a dog in this fight and we shouldn't vex ourselves about what he decides to do ultimately or not. What are your thoughts?
Well, two really important questions, and let me break them apart. So the first, and you know, having served in government for many years, this is what colors my approach to the first question, which is the answer is I don't know. I don't know if he's actually going to make a aggressive move and what's going to actually happen. So that's something that people directly involved in diplomatic negotiations with access to intelligence are going to have a better prediction of what's going on. And I think it's important for all of us to keep that in context as we're talking about this really important.
I don't think they know either, to be honest with you.
That also can be very concerning. The second part of, is this an important question? Absolutely. What we're seeing right now in terms of this, renewed, it's not new, it's just a renewed, aggression by Putin in Russia, is deeply concerning for a number of reasons that are both rooted in history and also of relevance today. You mentioned that, Putin famously said the fall of the Soviet Union was a, catastrophe, one of the greatest catastrophes of the 20th century. Along those lines, less frequently mentioned has been his relentless effort to rehabilitize Joseph Stalin and to rehabilitate his image as a leader. And that is deeply troubling. When we talk about one of the most heinous, criminals, tyrants of human history, responsible for tens of millions of deaths. Let me say at the outside, as you introduced me, we are the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. So we memorialize and try to educate about the more than 100 million victims of communism. I just want that to sink in. Most people are unaware of that number or anything approaching that number, that there are more than 100 million victims that died as a result, murdered as a result of communism. And Joseph Stalin personally was personally responsible for tens of millions. And under his leadership of the Soviet Union, his great terror, the Holodomor. I want to mention this one, given the topic we were raising, the Holodomor, which again, most Americans are unaware of a economically planned famine in Ukraine that resulted in the deaths of millions of Ukrainians. So
aimed at, depopulating the country.
That's right.
No,
that's right.
This is so important. And I just have to, maybe at the risk of quibbling, suggest that that number sounds awfully low to me. For example, the 400 million unborn Chinese that were aborted by the communist regime that you might throw into that mix in addition to the living who were murdered, as you say, in enormous quantities there as well as elsewhere. And it's ongoing. Let's be clear. It's not over in North Vietnam or North Korea and China. But that brings me to China, Mr. Ambassador. You worked tirelessly, I know, during your career in government against the Chinese Communist Party. Donald Trump did more than any president in our history, I think, really, to counter it. The job is undone, alas, and we seem to be heading in the wrong direction under a man who I believe has been deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, namely Joe Biden. You are having an event tomorrow on the Capitol grounds in which the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation and others will be, denouncing what I've been calling the genocide games that will be to begin the following day. Tell us about those games. What is at stake that we are, speaking of legitimizing, communism, going there, participating in these games, and inevitably the propaganda windfall that will be garnered by Xi Jinping and his Chinese Communist Party as a result.
So you really touched on the real key point at the very last end when you mentioned propaganda, but let me give you the kind of arc up to this. So as you mentioned, I was the ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva dealing with the Chinese Communist Party and dealing with other countries who, in my assessment, were not actually dealing with the challenge of the Chinese Communist Party. And that experience—
Worse yet, dealing in a very literal way.
Well, sure. Many that were, dealing directly with them and making, what are terrible deals for their own country. But then also did this larger cadre of countries that their orientation is in fact the right direction. They recognize the challenge or threat by China, but then were basically unwilling or unable to do anything about it. That was very eye-opening to me as a diplomat. But this is what brings me to the issue of the Olympics. So China, let's go back to 2008, a very different China from the world's perspective. Very few people in the United States were having a conversation 14 years ago like the one we're having today. China had put on a different face and had not, this is the pre-Xi Jinping era, and had not taken this hard Maoist turn to their kind of true kind of ideological root of, you know, Mao's CCP, which we've seen by Xi Jinping. But what did they do in 2008? They used this as both a domestic and an international propaganda tool to show, you know, China was now a leader in the world, and what the way they used the Olympics to do that. And the concern that I know I and many have had all along is that they were going to use this 2022 Olympics that kicks off this week in the exact same vein. And it's, you know, it's irresponsible, it's wrong, it's immoral for us that know better to become willing participants in this propaganda effort, right? I mean, you can't stop what the Chinese are going to do on their own accord. We can control our own behavior, right? And that's why for more than a year, we have been pushing and pleading that the IOC remove the games, delay the games, do anything they can to remove themselves from this, you know, incredibly immoral situation that they've put themselves in, to now be morally complicit with China's behavior. And let's pause and talk about the behavior for a sec. The behavior that we have seen and witnessed and have documented evidence of just in the last few years is incontrovertible and truly damning. You know, I always try to give the benefit of the doubt to people until there's no room for doubt, right? So that's right, exactly. So when the decision was originally made to put the Olympics there, you know, that was several years ago that you might have been cautious or weary of doing, but it was not what we've seen just in the last few years, the documented evidence of a genocide happening in the country. The decision by the Chinese Communist Party to violate their international agreement with the UK around Hong Kong of one country, two systems. And they chose in 2020, in the height of a pandemic, to violate that agreement, knowing there'd be muted to little global response, and take away the rights of those in Hong Kong to, you know, tear up that whole idea that there'd be one country as the British returned Hong Kong to mainland China, but two systems. And this is an important thing that I found in dealing with the Chinese and other countries as well. You know, we need to make them stand by their own word. They will frequently use this diplomatic ploy to suggest that you, in whatever position or critique you're making, you're this kind of aggressor, right? You're bringing up some new issue and you're the one disrupting the status quo. And it's a very effective tool they use because people frequently want to feel, well, I'm not the aggressor. Maybe I should be quiet and calm down, right? And they use that very effectively when, in fact, their actions are the ones that are changing the status quo, as they like to frequently say, and changing what's happening. You know, Hong Kong was, you know, under threat and under greater oppression, but still maintained more of their, you know, one country, two systems prior to the decision and active choice by the Chinese Communist Party to take away that freedom. And it's their actions that necessitate international responses by other countries, particularly the United States, which brings us back to the Olympic Games kicking off now. We are hosting a rally, a No Beijing 2022 rally at the U.S. Capitol tomorrow, or Thursday, February 3rd at 12, right at the feet of the Capitol. It's hosted by us at the Victims of Communism with our co-hosts, the Campaign for Uyghurs, China Aid, Dialogue China, Uyghur Human Rights Project, and other human rights organizations that want to bring greater attention to this moral atrocity that much of the world is going to, you know, participate in legitimizing and supporting the activities by the Chinese Communist Party during these Olympic Games. I think it was a minimal, necessary but insufficient act by our government to not send diplomatic delegations to the Olympic Games, but that is just not enough. I saw just polling this morning saying that, you know, while most Americans support that, you know, boycott, you know, had almost, you know, 40% or some number like that, we're unaware of it. And the whole reason they're unaware of it is because our leaders haven't talked about it. So I'm really hopeful we'll be talking about this at the rally tomorrow. I'm really hopeful our leaders, particularly, you know, in our executive branch, will use this time during the Olympics to publicly speak out and draw attention to the human rights violations being conducted by China today while these Olympic Games go on.
Well, listen, I commend you Andrew, for the work that you and your team are doing in general, but specifically for this very important event. I hope to be there myself. It's vital that we denounce what's going on here, especially against the backdrop of two other things that I don't think you mentioned. One is, of course, that, you know, there is a real danger to our athletes attending these games at the moment. The COVID or hemorrhagic fever or God only knows what else is abroad in China, and it's inside the wire, apparently, at the games as well. That's one reason they shouldn't be going. The others are ones you have mentioned. But overarching is, going back to what we just talked about Ukraine, of course, is the problem that if we treat the Chinese Communist Party in the face of these crimes against humanity, in the face of their overt, you know, designs on others, including Taiwan and India, we're likely to see them translate those, you know, signals from the West as Hitler did in 1936. Following his Olympic Games as indications that they can act aggressively with impunity. And we will rue the day we sent that message, because it will be an extremely costly one, not just for those most immediately affected, but for all of us, I believe. Let me ask you quickly before we run out of time with you, Ambassador Andrew Bremberg. We've had the privilege of working with one of your colleagues, Carlos Ponce, about communism's march. One of our colleagues, Joseph Heumeyer, has called it the authoritarian wave that is now sweeping across Latin America. We lost two important countries to the communists last year, Peru and Chile, and two more are very much in their crosshairs, the communists in Colombia and in Brazil. What should we be doing there, based on your extensive time in government and what the risks and stakes are in Latin America for losing the hemisphere to the communists, sir?
Well, you're exactly right. This is an incredibly important region, particularly to the United States. And what we've seen over the last, you know, many years, but as you mentioned, we're seeing accelerate in the last few years, is the spread of this, you know, Castro communism from Cuba. You know, we still have the, you know, the same dictatorial communist, you know, Castro regime in Cuba. We know that the partnership that they then developed with, you know, Hugo Chavez and now Maduro in Venezuela, and they are the engine of this export of, you know, communism across Latin America. And, you know, you mentioned those, you know, presidential elections that we saw in Peru and Chile and the upcoming elections later this year. I'll just add one more that's important. You know, in Chile, they have a constitutional convention. You know, Chile has been known as being one of the most, you know, economically developed, closest thing to a, you know, Western democracy actually functioning in the region. You know, they've had their own problems, but for many decades now, under their existing constitutional structure, they've, you know, done extremely well, and that's
thanks in part rewritten to an anti-communist by the name of Pinochet. I think it's fair to note.
Well, right, and what happens is that they're going to have a rewriting of their constitution and a referendum to try to approve that, and that will be another huge signal to see whether or not the country is able to, you know, stall the decline, right, to stop and reverse course. Or if it's going to, you know, dramatically sink further, because that'll be a huge challenge. But in terms of here in the United States, I mean, we need to be working with, and this is something our organization does, working with the diaspora of, you know, communities that are here in the United States that frequently have migrated and immigrated here, either just for, you know, better economic prospects or fleeing in many cases, these regimes. I mean, the Cuban Americans, the Venezuelans here in the United States now, are extremely articulate and well-educated about the challenge of communism and are some of the best explainers to their fellow Americans about what the challenge of communism poses. So working with those communities as well as those from other parts of Latin America to do two things. One, to educate their fellow Americans about the challenge and threat, because one of the biggest underlying problems we have is the degree to which Americans are just asleep or unaware. You know, people talk about being woke. They need to get woke to the challenge of communism in the 21st century, right? I mean, I was a student in 1989 when the wall fell. And I thought, you know, great, you know, the whole end of history, communism's over, we've won, this is done. And I joke, you know, everyone younger than me has basically never been vaccinated against communism. And most people my age or older probably need a booster shot, right? That
A great way to put it, sir, especially at this moment.
That's right. I think it's helpful in our pandemic context that, you know, people don't understand or remember what communism really meant. You know, the murder of 100 million people by the most heinous totalitarian regimes, that always did so in the name of, you know, in the name of equality and equity and making everything great for everyone. You know, people, of course, will joke that the way they succeed in that is making everyone poor. And what we need to do, coming back to Latin America, is not just educate Americans, but then help use that to help educate those in the country right now. I mean, you know, both Peru, Chile, Colombia, Brazil, these are countries where, you know, they have not had set in, you know, decades or longer of socialist communist regimes. So it's the hope that there is still time, right? But now is the time for those countries to make a big change.
Yeah. One of our colleagues who formerly was a vice president of Peru and whose company I think I first met you, Andrew Brumberg, namely Francisco Tudela, has just yesterday filed suit in the Congress in Peru, charging the president of that country, Pedro Castillo, with treason. It'll be very interesting to see what comes next, but I commend him for his courage and you for yours, sir, and for your great service to our country, which continues now at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Good luck with this very important program tomorrow against the Genocide Games, and especially in your efforts to try to prevent China, among others, from benefiting from the authoritarian wave in our own hemisphere. I know you'll keep up the good work, and I hope you come back to us with reports on it soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of my all-time favorite people. Jackie Daly. Is that what I call you, Jackie?
You can call me Jackie from the Jackie Daly Show. That's fine.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay.
She's one of my all-time favorite people. Her name is Jackie from the Jackie Daly Show. She has been an extraordinarily important contributor to the public policy and national security of the United States in a number of different capacities, including as legislative counsel for Congressman Trent Franks when he chaired the Constitution Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. She has gone on to a number of other things, including work with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and is the host of the Jackie Daly Show. Again, among other many important attributes, just one of the smartest people, particularly on, well, national security broadly defined, and in particular, energy security. And that is topic A for us today with her. Jackie, it's so good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome.
It's so good to be with you, and thank you so much for that very, very generous introduction, Frank. I always look forward to talking with you any chance I get, and your visits to Texas when we get to actually sit down and talk it out are some of my favorites. So thank you for everything you do.
Thank you, and back at you. Jackie, I wanted to touch quickly on a couple of different pieces in that energy security portfolio of yours, one of which is the fact that Joe Biden seems to be determinedly dismantling our energy security. And you follow these things closely, both from the vantage point of someone living in the heart of America's energy sector in Texas, but also, you know, in terms of the national energy security situation, talk us through what Biden has done to date to take us from, well, what was energy independence, we were told, under Donald Trump, to something far short of that mark now.
It seems like Biden's every move on this topic is to make us less energy secure and more dependent on our foreign adversaries as possible. Every move. I mean, he's probably made, you know, 24 big decisions on energy policy since taking office. Not one of them favored U.S. energy producers or the United States security. Not one. And I mean, I could walk you through. Some of them are very well known. Like, you know, stopping construction of American pipelines on day one, strategic pipelines, permitting the Russians to go forward with whatever they would like to do with their pipelines on the flip side,
right,
by removing American sanctions or whatever we could have done to stop it, to, you know, being very back and forth on fracking, depending on who he's talking to, which is over 90% of U.S. oil and gas production right there. And, you know, doing what he can to stop federal permits and leases and offshore work and ANWR and you name it. Anything this guy can do to tie our hands behind our back is what he does.
And I describe this as a wrecking operation. It's fits a larger pattern, of course, in terms of what the Biden administration is doing in so many spaces. Of course, our southern border comes to mind near where you all live. But it's concerning in particular because, as you say, it's compounded by enhancing the leverage and power of our enemies at the same time. And it seems almost unimaginable that this could be done deliberately, purposefully, and so comprehensively.
It was the America that he was used to, in a sense, because as you will recall, up until the fracking revolution, which really hit its stride around 2012, we were entering into a time of more and more dependence, which had been going on for decades. So for someone like him, who's been in the Senate for most of my life, for sure, this kind of submission to lesser powers is just normal for him. Maybe he doesn't think it's a big deal, but I will tell you that if you look to his transactions, I'm talking about money changing hands from our adversaries to his family. That could go a long way toward explaining why he might behave this way. I never miss an opportunity to point out that there were two huge, scandalous deals that Hunter Biden did in the years after the second Obama-Biden term that were didn't get the press they should have and should have been disqualifying for Joe Biden to be president. One was with Ukraine. One was with China. Both of them were energy deals. These are fossil fuel deals. For a company or for a family that's so opposed to fossil fuels in the name of, you know, stopping the rise of the oceans and climate change, they're awfully happy to get in line to take money for fossil fuel deals that benefit, again, other countries. They're all about advising and sitting on the boards or doing the deals for others. But stopping those foreign countries' competition, which is the United States, at every turn.
Jackie, this is such an important point, and it's just further evidence of the rank hypocrisy, as well as the cynicism and corruption, as you say, of this Biden administration. I wanted to just say another pipeline, by the way, and I know you were not overlooking it; it just didn't come up, but that the administration has also seen fit to interfere with, as I understand it, that benefits, again, our adversaries, namely Russia, and its effort to dominate the energy supplies to our European allies, is one coming out of Israel. It's just another example, I think. And you didn't mention in your litany of corrupt transactions, perhaps because it wasn't necessarily an energy play, but the mayor of Moscow's wife also greased the palms of the Biden family to the tune of some $3 million or so. And presumably that would have been a further incentive to accommodate the Russians if any were needed. Jackie, the thing that is so worrying about this is our energy insecurity is bad enough, but what the Russians have been able to with Biden ending the objections to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that Donald Trump had very aggressively expressed, is essentially, I think, an unbelievable opportunity for Putin to wage energy warfare against not only our nominal allies, I'm thinking Germany in particular, but also, Ukraine and Poland, who will no longer be able to get either the access to gas or the transit fees because of this new pipeline that circumvents both of them. Talk us through that, if you would, please.
Okay, so let's think about there are very few things that I think Russia does well, but there are a few. They export oil and gas. weapons, and espionage. That's what they deal in, right? And that's the whole game for them. They don't have a Silicon Valley. They don't have a Hollywood. They don't really have manufacturing. This is they're a three-trick pony, and they're very good at it, espionage in particular. Let me give you what I think was the perfect illustration, especially as you mentioned Germany just now. I'm sure you know this, but few people do. Back in the early aughts, Gerhard Schroeder was Chancellor of Germany. And so he plunges Germany headlong into wind and solar, especially solar, back at a time when it was about 90% more expensive and even less effective. And that made Germany more dependent on Russia for fossil fuels to stay alive. Then guess what? Schroeder goes to Russia and becomes chairman of the Russian energy company Rosneft since 2017. Yes. Now, come on. I mean,
the champion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Absolutely. Well. Absolutely.
Prime lobbyist for the Russians.
Absolutely. So as far as I'm concerned, this guy sold out Germany, and I'll bet he's being rewarded. Now, that's my view of it. And in the same way, the Bidens have taken a ton of money for deals that benefited Russia and others. And so I guess I would say this. Russia won these battles, these influence battles and these economic battles. It's economic warfare because we are really only as strong as our weakest link. And if you elect someone to the top who has no character, no morals, no principles, hypocrisy is fine. This is what we're going to get. And so it drives home the point that, you know, they only have to buy off, Frank, one American in theory to get a lot done. And so can I prove to you, can I read Joe Biden's heart and tell you in his own mind or Hunter's mind or his brother's mind, who's also doing these deals, that this is what they're intending to do? I can imagine the counterarguments right now. All I can tell you is, with politics, you never ever judge a politician by their words, only their actions.
That's all.
And the actions are so troubling. No, you're absolutely right, Jackie, and very well said, of course. The other piece of this that I just wanted to touch on with you quickly that is also a very important energy security issue. In fact, it is a national and homeland security issue. It is a public health and safety issue. And that is the vulnerability of our grid. And we had a chance to visit when I was in Dallas last week with you, and we talked a bit about the fact that the grid of Texas is a prime example. And we witnessed February a year ago the devastating effects of the investment that Texas government has placed in building out their own grid. And they have their own grid for much of Texas, as you know, Jackie, on solar and wind, contributed to just a devastating shutdown, blackout in parts of your state for a long period of time. And there's a concern, even as soon as this weekend, that there may be another storm, and it will demonstrate that nothing materially has been done to correct the underlying problems that existed a year ago. Is that correct in your estimation? And if so, are we looking at, paying a very high price possibly for lessons unlearned?
Well, we're about to find out. We have this weekend, or actually starting tonight, as you know, a massive winter storm coming through. I don't know that it would be anywhere near what we had last year, but it is just a matter of time. If it isn't now, it might be in the summer, because Texans tend to have peak demand in the summer when it's hot. But it's sooner than later. This is going to happen again. So last year was not a one-off event. It is what happened. Did not happen because we had weather that was so unusual. It happened because we had weather that was unusual combined with a suicidal energy policy, which is we are going to somehow, move 500,000 new Texans into the state every year. And those are the legal ones, right? You got maybe potentially another 2 million coming across the southern border. This is a lot of demand increase. And at the same time, we're going to decommission fossil fuels or nuclear plants, which would be the reliable energy, dispatchable at any time.
Base load.
Thank you. Yeah. We call it thermal sometimes, or traditional energy. And instead increase and build out the amount of wind and solar, which is unreliable, intermittent energy that typically performs at its worst when it's needed the most, such as during a winter storm. As we saw last year, at one point, wind generation collapsed down to 1.5%. 1.5% of what it's capable of in theory, because literally either the turbines froze or there was another problem. Texas made very minor adjustments to try to remedy the problem, and it didn't solve the fundamental problem, which is that we don't have enough capacity. We don't have enough energy, period, for the people who are here, and certainly for the people who are moving here. And until we build more, we can't fix the problem. And Governor Abbott, I saw him at his speech saying, as I speak, we're building more capacity under the grid. What he's not telling you is that that's almost entirely more wind, which again, will be, that doesn't solve anything.
That doesn't help us.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. If anything, it makes you more dependent. And the absence of that resilient, reliable baseload power could bring this grid again to a screeching halt, and people could die. Some did in that last storm, as I recall, a perfect storm. Yeah, Jackie, this is such an important issue. And again, you understand it. You've worked with Congressman Trent Franks, as I mentioned, one of the great champions of grid resiliency. And particularly, he was concerned, as I think we all have to be, about not just winter weather, for heaven's sakes, or peak demand in the summertime, but people actually trying to take the grid down. And interestingly enough, it was a particular focus of his efforts, as it has been of ours, that electromagnetic pulse might be the way that's done by potent adversaries, or, you know, sabotage, perhaps, or cyber warfare. Or maybe it's just Mother Nature doing it another way, these huge geomagnetic disturbances. But whatever it is, present grid in Texas and across the country is vulnerable, as you know. And I so appreciate what you do on the Jackie Daly program week upon week, as you help people understand what the implications of such disastrous policies are and the necessity of correcting, lest we really put ourselves and our country, our civilization, for heaven's sakes, in extreme peril. So, Jackie, thank you for visiting with me about this today. I hope that this will be a regular feature of our program going forward in 2022, because there is so much to talk about, and you are really one of the duty experts on it, and your clarity as well as your vision and drive is so appreciated here. So come back to us again soon if you would, and I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.